This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the United States claims that it's in Syria to fight Al-Qaeda, but the Al-Qaeda affiliate in that country has disappeared from U.S. terrorist lists. Black students at Temple University explore the Black Panther Party's approach to social revolution, and Mumia Abu-Jamal says goodbye to a Native American activist. But first, the people of Puerto Rico, a U.S. colony in the Caribbean, are confronting much the same economic powers that bankrupted Detroit 4 years ago and stripped the citizens of that Black metropolis of control over their local affairs. We spoke with Abayomi Azikwe, editor of the Detroit-based Pan-African News website. Azikwe says finance capital, the bankers, are behind the misery in both Detroit and Puerto Rico, where hurricanes have wrecked the economy and plunged the island further into debt.
Yeah, you have some of the same players at work who were involved in the Detroit bankruptcy. They had to, of course, change the methodology under which municipalities can declare bankruptcy. In Detroit, it was never any of the elected officials. It was never a vote of the people. In fact, the people had voted just over a year before in opposition to emergency management, but yet they had to, in effect, change the rules in order to provide the capacity to declare bankruptcy. And now they say that the city has emerged from bankruptcy some 3 years ago. Yet, during the emergency management and bankruptcy process, the shedding of the so-called debt was done on the backs of the retirees, the city employees, and all the residents of the city of Detroit through the theft of $5.5 billion in pension funds. You also had the, in essence, privatization of Belle Isle, one of the largest public parks in the country, Detroit Public Works System, Detroit Public Lighting, and other public assets, including Detroit Institute of Arts, were in essence taken from the control of the majority of the people who live here in the city. In Puerto Rico, after the so-called bankruptcy and plan of adjustment in Detroit, Judge Stephen Rhodes, who presided over the procedures here, was hired in Puerto Rico by financial interests to essentially carry out the same process. Cencora, which is a bond insuring firm that was involved in what I call corporate capture of public resources in Detroit, are also involved in Puerto Rico. In Detroit, they said it was a question of $18 billion in debt. In Puerto Rico, it is some $72 billion in debt. And of course, both areas, Puerto Rico being ostensibly a commonwealth, is in effect a colony. Detroit, which is a majority African-American population in the city, is in essence an internal colony as well. So the similarities are quite striking.
Yes, it seems that under the rule of capital, whether one is a commonwealth, a colony, or part of the contiguous and recognized United States, the same people have the power.
Yes, and that is the banks. And of course, they control the local municipalities, either by force or by consent. And in Detroit, we have, even in the post-bankruptcy period, what is known as the Financial Review Commission. They are, in fact, the actual city council of Detroit. The elected city council cannot take any position that the Financial Review Committee considers in contravention to the so-called plan of adjustment, which was given legal cover through the exiting of the bankruptcy. And Puerto Rico, for example, was even no law, no provision that would allow Puerto Rico to declare bankruptcy. And the U.S. Congress had to create such a mechanism for this to take place. So here again, you have, against the will of the people, these financial decisions made by a small group of people being enacted to the detriment of the majority of the people.
Have activists in Puerto Rico and Detroit been taking notes and otherwise pooling their brains at least?
Well, yeah, we've had contact with activists there. In fact, some were here several months ago. And we have, of course, been expressing solidarity in our respective struggles, but still, it's not enough. There needs to be more joint action between Puerto Rico and not just the city of Detroit, but all oppressed people across the United States, people in the financial capital of the world, being Wall Street or in New York City, should, of course, be outraged about what's going on in Puerto Rico because it portends much for the United States as well.
Quicken Loans doesn't have any problem with the powers that be, the new powers that be in Detroit, does it?
No. In fact, they are giving them all kinds of incentives, i.e. Tax money that should be going to help the schools, municipal services, to help neighborhoods, is in fact going to Dan Gilbert. And there's been numerous exposés on that in recent weeks from various quarters. There's a new plan to turn over approximately $1 billion to Quicken Loans for a project, a prestige project, to rebuild the old J.L. Hudson's department store site on Woodward Avenue.
And in fact, it appears that Dan Gilbert is actually the developer deciding what priorities and the actual physical layout of the future and present Detroit.
Yeah, he does not want the Wayne County Jail in downtown. He wants to instead to build a $1 billion soccer stadium along with the owner of the Detroit Pistons. So, yeah, he's determining what goes where and what should go where.
One wonders if one or a bevy of billionaire sugar daddies are assembling to establish their sovereignty over Puerto Rico.
Well, there's no question about it. We see the attitude of President Donald Trump when he went down there. He disrespected the people on numerous occasions. He had nothing but venom directed at the mayor of San Juan, Puerto Rico. And yes, they don't care if the majority of the people in Puerto Rico leave. This just provides a mechanism for them to carry out their bidding. The hurricane that hit the country, of course, is a tragedy because due to the role of the financial institutions, which have crippled the capacity of the public sector in Puerto Rico to reverse the horrible conditions as a result of the hurricane. Most of the people there still do not have power. They have serious problems with water and food. Whereas you contrast that with Cuba, which has restored power, had restored power in a matter of weeks. But you have a socialist system in Cuba and a colonial capitalist system in Puerto Rico. I just wanted to point out that there's a lesson for people in other municipalities around the United States. We can look at what's happening in places like Chicago and in the Bay Area of California and many other cities where they're heading in the same direction as Detroit and Puerto Rico. The sooner people realize it, the better mechanism they can develop to fight it. Not just in the short term, but it's going to be a long-term struggle.
That was Abayomi Ezekwe of Pan-African News speaking from Detroit. The United States claims it's fighting a war on terror in the world and bombing terrorists daily in Syria. But the Al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria, which used to be called the Al-Nusra Front but changed its name, has disappeared from U.S. lists of terrorist organizations. The Syrian government and Russia charge Washington with forming an alliance with Al-Qaeda in Syria. We spoke with Dr. Gerald Horn, the prolific author and professor of history at the University of Houston.
The United States and U.S. imperialism face a very difficult choice right now. That is to say, the so-called Islamic State apparently has suffered setbacks on the Syrian-Iraqi border. But at the same time, may and probably does see the Islamic Republic of Iran as more of a threat than the so-called Islamic State. And given the historic precedents we've already cited, where the United States has not been adverse to playing a double game, that is to say, leaping in bed at the slightest opportunity with religious zealots, it may not be beyond the bounds of reality to suggest that the United States may try to broker some sort of covert relationship with the so-called Islamic State in order to target the Islamic Republic of Iran, which, as you know, has been a bulwark of support for the Syrian government of President al-Assad, not to mention his neighbors across the border in Iraq. In light of the fact that as we speak, President Putin is in Iran, conferring with high-level authorities about tightening support for the Damascus-based regime, we should not rule out the possibility of some sort of nefarious alliance with religious zealots who we're told the United States is sworn to subdue and destroy.
U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, meanwhile, is demanding that Iran, a close ally of the Iraqi government, get out of Iraq.
Well, I think that Secretary Tillerson will be departing Washington for his sprawling ranch in Texas before the Iranians get out of Iraq. Mr. Tillerson should be concerned about his own job security. Some might say, a la Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee, that Mr. Tillerson also should be concerned about being castrated by Mr. Trump. Now, I'm not sure if he meant that literally, but perhaps your listeners may be reassured to know that Mr. Tillerson went before cameras just a few days ago to note that he remains, quote, intact, unquote. So certainly this loose talk by Mr. Tillerson needs to be dismissed. It should not be taken seriously. And certainly he is yesterday's man.
That was Dr. Gerald Horn of the University of Houston. Students and community members gathered late last month at Philadelphia's Temple University to discuss the life and times of Huey P. Newton, the co-founder of the Black Panther Party. One of the speakers at the all-day conference was Kashara White of the Philadelphia Saturday Free School. Ms. White recalled the battle over the future of Temple's African American Studies program 2 years ago that resulted in the firing of activist professor Anthony Montero and the promotion to department head of Molefi Asante, who calls himself an Africologist. Kashara White told the conference that young activists can learn from the Black Panther Party's experience, in which party members were killed by cultural nationalists on a college campus in Los Angeles.
When I changed my major to African American Studies, I was open to a world of thought that centered Black experiences. So just to give y'all an idea of where I'm from Mansion. Like, y'all know where Strawberry Mansion is in Philadelphia?
Yeah.
That's where I'm from. I went to the high school there. That high school has a reputation, right? And in the city, and so does the area. It's one of the poorest zip codes in the city. We're sitting in 19112 and 19122 are two of the poorest zip codes in Philadelphia. And Temple operates in 19122. Mm-hmm. So just to give you an idea of the type of how the power that Temple has in this area is absolute. Because it's all poor people here. It's nobody that owns their house. They could just... It's absolute. So in my education, me coming up, I had Black teachers. I had probably just as many Black teachers as I had white teachers. And everybody treated Blackness as pathology, as Huey describes it. You're pathological because you're Black. You're poor because you're Black. You can't read because you're Black. This is what all Black people know. This is the system of education in America. So when I got to AFAM, I was amazed. Like, it was just so much. First of all, Africology, I'm critical of Africology, but the reason why I'm critical of it is because it influenced me. And so Africology, it's like a way of approaching scholarship, right? And so fundamentally what it does is places the African as the agent, and it stops looking at Black people as pathological necessarily. And so proceeding from that point, now I can read a book about myself and not have to look at myself as the problem. Right? But Du Bois did that before Afrocology was even thought of. So we really don't have to go to the school of thought that I'm coming up under because I'm in African American Studies at Temple. Wow. And I just want to make myself clear. Like, I graduated high school in 2010. So, and I came in and out of school money. Like, so I just want to be clear that Afrocology was just one of the many schools of thought at the time. In 2010, it was, everybody was here. It was Black womanists, Africana womanists, all types of different ideologies. You had Pan-Africanists, Afrocentrists, Black socialists and communists. Everybody was in one department. There was open debate. Everybody studied together. People had problems with each other. They talked about the problems that they had. And so what I loved about the department was there were Garveyites instead of Jeffersonians. Like, we read Fanon instead of Aristotle. Like, everybody, if you had sense, you were reading Asada's book. Like, that's how, from on the academic level, like, I'm not even talking about activism. Like, I'm talking about just reading books, writing papers, the regular shit that everybody does in school, right? So everybody collaborated. And so for me, like, reading Revolutionary Suicide was like a huge eye-opener because it was my first introduction, really, into class. Like, I really didn't have a class analysis. So when I read Huey, I kind of got this new analysis. And my first reading of the book is, I step away from it, I'm like, okay, I can't just talk about this stuff, I gotta be about it, I have to do something. And it just so happened that at that time, the graduate students they hosted a rally where Dr. Montero spoke, I was in his class, like, we were really thinking. Like, let's be real, like, we were really thinking, we were really learning. And a big part of that was the fact that we had the philosophy circle, which eventually led to the Saturday School. So, like, the Black Radical Philosophy Circle was something that we got a lot of bullshit for. So the philosophy circle, we started out of our studying in class. And what happened is just what happens at the Saturday School is we would invite the community as well as students from different disciplines, not just African American studies, to study philosophy. And we studied Du Bois, we studied Huey, we studied everybody. And we didn't just focus on Black thinkers, but we also focused on critiquing other thinkers, and especially European thinkers in our critiques anyway. So the graduate students host a rally to save Black studies. Why do Black studies need to be saved? So as an undergraduate student, I'm thinking, well, there's a core class that I have, like, I needed to graduate, and they're only offering it one semester out the year, and it's at 6:30 in the evening. Stuff like that. That's what's happening to us. We don't have a lot of resources. We don't have a lot of, like, respect from the administration, and we were losing faculty left and right. And as a result of us losing faculty so much, like, the chair who had retired, there was a void. Somebody needed to be the chair of the department, and apparently they wanted to make a white woman the chair instead of one of the professors who were already tenured. And so fight ensues over the department. The graduate students support the faculty because Carrie Amu Welsh, that's who we wanted to be the chair. So Carrie Amu Welsh, we wanted her to be the chair. They wanted some other lady to be the chair. It was like this really systemic way that they were just trying to slide her in without nobody seeing. And so, like, obviously, we're not stupid, and so grad students rally, undergrad students rally, and from there, I kind of started being an activist. And so, like, all the young people who were part of that first rally ended up creating multiple other organizations from that point on that would follow in the years that, well, I would kind of call it the struggle to save the department, which at first, it was about not getting a white woman as chair, but eventually it turned into this struggle and this internal conflict about cultural nationalism or revolutionary socialism, right? And that's really what the bottom line is when we talk about Asante and Montero. So why should you even become an activist? The reason is really simple. And Huey kind of draws these things out, and I want to actually read from his speech, The Correct Handling of a Revolution. And so there are a few concrete reasons that a student who's just trying to get their, you know, get their degrees in should be an activist. And I want to say that it's because your education should be one rooted in liberation. So if you're adhering to this sort of academic understanding of what your education is supposed to be, then maybe you shouldn't be an activist because it don't really matter. But if you want liberation for all people, if you want liberation of humanity, then you should definitely get down with this stuff that Huey was talking about. And so the first thing is learn by doing. Huey says, there are three ways one can learn. Through study, observation, and experience. To learn by studying is good, but to learn by experience is better. So like everything that I'm about to tell y'all about what happened to John Huggins and Bunchy Carter connects back to what happened at Temple's campus. It's not because I read a book. It's not because I heard a lecture. It's not because I listened to prison radio even. It's because I literally lived it and I walked through it and I saw it happen. So like when Dr. Regina is telling us that they came in there with guns, I'm telling y'all that the people who snitch on me to the cops is these same folks. You know what I'm saying? So like that's what the connection is. The other thing is, you have to learn to lead by example. The purpose of the Vanguard is to lead the people. The primary job of the party, this is what Huey says, is to provide leadership for the people. It must teach by words and action the correct strategic methods for prolonged resistance. James Baldwin, this phrase called the long meantime. He talks about there being this sort of space between our subjugation and our liberation. Being the long meantime. That means you have to work towards it. It's going to be generations until we get it. But every generation makes certain steps forward. Like what the Panthers did is infamous. Like they changed the whole world. And so activists like Bunchy Carter, that's what we do. So my issue with a lot of the people in African American studies today is that these people might speak about liberation, but when they say liberation, they don't have a concrete definition. Huey and the Black Panther Party had a very concrete definition of what they meant by liberation. Along with that, Afrocentricity. Who hasn't liberated on the planet? Think about it. Like, what political prisoners do y'all know is in jail right now because they are Afrocentric? think about it. Like, you cannot lead, you can't tell me that what you're doing is leadership, but you haven't led nobody. Where are the Afrocentric marches, right? Where are the Afrocentric free breakfast clubs? Where are the book clubs? They just want you to buy their books. That's how I see it. And I'm from North Philly, and I know a hustler when I see a hustler. The other practical reason to become an activist is because to be war ready, you have to be battle tested. Huey says, to minimize the danger of Uncle Tom informers and opportunists, the members of the Vanguard group should be tested revolutionaries. That means that you can't just leave college and just join a socialist party. You can't just leave college and decide like and elevate yourself around a bunch of Black people and decide like I'm this messiah. I've seen like all types of stuff that's happening in the world right now around this Black stuff, right? I've seen some young people, they have moved down to Central America. Now they all locked up because they following some man with locks and he got a nice chest or whatever. You know what I'm saying? Like, I've seen these people create these cults of personalities, and then you got people shipped to another country, and they messed up. They think that they're doing something for liberation. They think that they're doing something progressive, but really what they're doing is feeding this person's ego at their own expense of their life. And it's not different in the university. It's not different in these schools. And so I'll just tell y'all this short story. We're knee deep in the Montero struggle, and so some activists had this idea that we're gonna take over Sullivan Hall. We did it before, we could do it again, right? That's what we said. And we had this really bad plan where we're gonna go into the Bloxy collection and act like we're all studying, like everybody like 40 of us are gonna go study in a Bloxy collection, whatever. But so like maybe like 6 or 7 of us show up to the Bloxy like during our little time slots that we have all planned out. And lie to you not, the person who, like that person was a person in the AFAM department. We knew that person well. We knew that once there started to become split amongst the Black people, because everybody was together when it was against the white lady. But then once it becomes split against the Black people, we knew that this person wasn't necessarily on our side. But deep in my heart, I didn't think, if anything, you would confront me like, yo, why are you in here? Like, get out. But no, they ain't do that, none of that. They called the folks on us. And so it's not that, I don't want to make it seem that what happened on this campus is anywhere on the magnitude of what happened to the Panthers. But I can say, and I can point out faces, and I can say names of the people who, the same folks that attacked us for literally the same things that they were doing. We were setting up breakfast programs. We were setting up book clubs. We were trying to do all those things because we're trying to follow in Huey's footsteps and in Angela's footsteps and in Asada's footsteps. That's what we saw ourselves doing. These same people are now running the Department of African American Studies. And so what does that mean about education? What does that mean for our education that we're going to be receiving? It means that it's inherently anti-communist. It means that they can talk about Fanon, but they don't talk about Fanon. It means they can mention Fanon to discredit his socialist background. They talk about his white wife, right? Or, and anything, I think, any dissent becomes un-African, right? If you slap not, it's not African on it, then black kids, and I think it's really important to say that black youth are very much so empowered. And I think the cultural nationalists, they use our ignorance, they use our vulnerability. The fact that we feel, everybody feels some type of way that they don't know their history, that it's been taken from them. And they use that to prey on us, like to say, like, I have these solutions. But the solutions are very much individualistic. It's about you trying to make money. I got cornered knee deep in the Montero struggle. These same folks cornered me in their office and talked to me for hours and hours and tried to flip me on my car rack, telling me that they can, you know, make sure I graduate and get, you know, whatever the case is, whatever they think that they can give me. Them flipping you is easier when you don't know Huey and when you don't know Du Bois and when you haven't read Asada. It is, because I didn't get flipped. I ain't go nowhere. I'm still here. So it's so much easier because you don't know, like, especially, and they use their academic students in general, where they use their book knowledge to try to make you feel stupid, like the decisions that you're making with your life is stupid. But the thing about it is the knowledge that Huey and Elaine and all the Panthers passed down to us, it can be applied. You can actually use it in the world, and you will see results. You will get your friends out of jail where they don't belong. You will liberate your community. You will feed people who are hungry. You will literally change the world. That's the thing. These people don't want to change the world. They just want to change how they can move in. That's very important. Cultural nationalists don't want to change the world. It's about not changing the relationship between capital and humanity. It's about changing the relationship between how white people see black people. And they even say things like, we should be more like the Indians because people respect Indian culture, right? People respect, but that's what it's about. It's about respecting somebody's culture as it is. But I mean, they use words that say, like, they're not juxtaposing themselves to white supremacy or Eurocentricity. But what does that mean if you're not going to say, like, hey, that's wrong and it's right? Well, then what are we really saying about the world that we live in? And I think that it's really important to see this as the main reason that cultural nationalism is accepted by white supremacy. Why is it embraced? One, because they'll snitch on you. They will tell the pub. They will tell the administration what you're doing. Two, it's because, and why would they snitch? Because they want money. It's about being having a positive relationship to capitalism. And their black nationalism is not Huey's black nationalism. I don't think, nationalism is not inherently wrong. Because that's not what I'm trying to say. Nationalism is not inherently wrong, but it's a way of going about it. And so Huey, he always had a way with words. He endearingly called cultural nationalism pork chop nationalism. And the way that I would describe this ideology is an ideology that claimed that rediscovering some supposedly unitary African culture would eventually lead to a revolution. So if all of the Africans in Africa and all of the Africans in the diaspora practice the same African culture, or synthesize this culture, right? Then we would just have a revolution. That's it. And so all them classes y'all about to pay for, That's it. That's it. Because they don't have no countries under a banner of cultural nationalism that have been liberated because of cultural nationalism. They don't have a Cuba. They don't have an equivalent. They don't have an equivalent to the Angolan Revolution. They don't have an equivalent. It doesn't exist. So that's literally it. What we want to fight for in our education and in our historiography of the world is revolutionary socialism. We want people to understand the ideology which claims that there is no way except a revolution to end this system. There is no other way. The only way that we can end this system is if we have a revolution, and the only way we can have a revolution is if we build it. It's not gonna come out the clear blue sky, and we'll come out of, we're not gonna see it on our diaper symbols. It's not, no. We have to build it, we gotta put in the work. We have to be uncomfortable, and we have to challenge the education that we've been given. In order to educate ourselves truly, we have to decolonize our education. And to do that, we cannot replace one toxic cultural perspective with another cultural perspective. I think there are many cultures, and I think that academia allows you to do this thing where you're like, where they can really go really deep, right? You can go really deep, and there's this deep focus on terminology and not the acquiring of knowledge. We know these words, we know these places, we know these people, we know the year that this crazy stuff happened in this area, and we know the customs of this land or whatever. What do we learn though? Our ancestors have something to give us from our history. They have something to teach us. And so if we're walking away and we can name all the states and whatever that white people made up in Africa, that's dope or whatever. Or we can name all the ancient African civilizations. That's dope or whatever, but like, what did we learn? And how can we utilize that for now? I don't think cultural nationalists have the answer to that, and I don't think they want to find the answer to that either. And I think that we have to take very, 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 very seriously, because cultural nationalism is something that is happening in the world right now, and it is destroying people. I'm done. All
right. That was Keshara White at Temple University in Philadelphia. In New York City, the activist organization Black Youth Project 100 is engaged in a campaign against the exclusionary practices of the state, including banning people from public housing if a family member is arrested. Rahel McDim-Pekka is an organizer with Black Youth Project 100. She's also working on the Swipe It Forward campaign, which urges subway users with unlimited mass transit cards to help others avoid being arrested for non-payment of fare.
There's no reason to believe that Black folks are jumping turnstiles at a higher rate than white people, right? But we know that 90% of those arrested are Black and brown, and there's a reason for that. So, you know, some people had some pushback. There's a couple of white folks who were like, you know, I'm poor too, why can't I get a swipe? And it just allowed for some conversation. More importantly, though, there were Black folks who were like, well, why not swipe in for white people? And that allowed for some conversation as well. That's the conversation I'm interested in having, right, with Black folks, about how we can better understand and, like, better work through the ways that the same systems of economic oppression impact Black folks very differently from how they impact white or white-presenting people. Yeah, and in Harlem specifically, where we were on 125th, and it's a very rapidly gentrifying area. There's a lot more white people than in other spaces where we've done it. But knowing the way that New York City works, every station that we've done the action at, we always try to pick stations that we know have a high concentration of Black and brown folks who are going to potentially need to hop the turnstile. And no matter where we go, there's still going to be a lot of folks, right? A lot of gentrifiers there. And it brings about some interesting conversations, but also brings about a lot of people who are like, yeah, like, I understand, like, this makes sense. But it's very important into our vision to make sure that we're centering Black and brown folks.
And as you're mentioning, this is something that people are being arrested for at ridiculously high rates. It was the number one cause for arrest in New York City in 2015, numbering nearly 30,000 arrests for this. For those who are not as familiar with the MTA and, you know, the New York City subway system, could you just share some of your experience outside of these swipe it forward actions as far as just what you've seen or experienced personally as regards targeting, harassment, etc. in the train station?
For sure, yeah. I mean, I think that if you talk to any New Yorker, anyone who's been in New York for more than a year or so, who is Black or brown, they can tell you times that they've seen either experienced themselves being harassed or seen someone being arrested or ticketed for a variety of reasons, right? But one of the major ones is hopping a turnstile. I mean, I can't really count the number of times I've seen somebody be arrested, seen somebody be ticketed, seen someone in the midst of being ticketed where, like, a warrant pops up, and so they end up going away in handcuffs over the turnstile. This is even intensified. Like, so MTA, it's $2.75 to get onto the subway or to get onto a normal bus, right? But then you have to pay an additional charge to get on select bus service. So MTA, even the way that, like, folks are ticketed for not having the select bus service ticket, right? I remember one specific time I was on my way to an action, a different kind of action, and a young black man was standing by the turnstiles clearly looking for a swipe, and I swiped him in. But I swiped him in from inside of the gate where you get on the train, and after swiping him in, he had his bicycle, so I opened the emergency gate for him and he came in. Three cops came from different directions, you know, plain clothes, because they stand and watch and pray, because it's not about protecting anybody, right? It's about being sneaky and trying to catch somebody in something. So yeah, so three officers came out of nowhere. They said, oh, you let him in through the gate. I said, well, like, first of all, like, y'all are a lot right now. They came up, surrounded us real quick. But also, you know, I swiped him in, like, calm down. And they had us standing there for a while they were, like, looking, because they had just missed me swiping him in. But regardless, it just shows that they're like vultures. They sit and wait for one thing to come and swoop down on a person over a $2.75 fee. But yeah, I mean, like, the stories like that are countless of people, you know, getting chased onto the train after jumping. And also, the thing that's really interesting is that if you talk to anybody, I know I have never seen a white person get ticketed or arrested for jumping a turnstile. I know that I have certainly seen many, many white people jumping a turnstile. I've seen just as many white people as I've seen Black people jumping a turnstile. But I've never seen a white person being apprehended, ticketed, summoned, you know? And for us, that goes without saying, like, yeah, of course they're not, you know? But people really need to hear that, and that that's a problem. And it's not about a difference in how often folks are jumping turnstiles or anything. It's about enforcement, about criminalization, about racialization.
As you mentioned, these actions have been going on for some time now with the Coalition to End Broken Windows. And there have been moments in the longer history of the city where these kinds of actions have cropped up. Do you see currently a greater push as regards swiping it forward and these kinds of actions? And do you see an impact of these actions as regards enforcement and or cultural sensibilities regarding swiping people in?
Yeah, for sure. It's amazing, actually, how widespread kind of the language of it has become, right? I've heard people who don't even know about the action, who maybe just saw a flyer on, and you know, the kind of communications and flyering work for this coalition have been incredible, with the swipe forward stickers, with the handouts that just really laid down in the most basic sense, you know, it is not illegal to swipe in a fellow New Yorker. It is not illegal to offer someone a swipe. It is not illegal to accept a swipe from a person, but it is illegal to ask for a swipe. And just like the kind of like heightened awareness of like just telling folks, you know, when if you have an unlimited card, or even if you just have an extra $2.75 to spare or something, when you come out of the subway and your card is good to go, like just look around the station and see if there's somebody kind of standing. Because they're not going to, more often than not, they're not going to come right up to you and ask for a swipe when they need it, because it's been criminalized to ask for what you need. Yeah, I think I have seen just like an increase in folks like just coming off the train and looking around trying to see if there's folks who low-key need a swipe. And I think that that's a part of the goal. I don't think it's like the ultimate goal, right? But I think that's a part of the goal. It's just like a community shift where we're holding each other, because at the end of the day, like, we got us. And that's like the beginning to actually change the system as it is.
And as an organizing tool, how effective do you find these swipe it forward actions to be? Are people expressing an interest in participating in future actions? And do you find that more organizations are building around this question of providing free swipes to the community members?
Yeah, I think that, you know, I think that, as I was mentioned earlier, but a really dope organizer that I had the pleasure of working with the last few years has this way of like framing types of direct actions and how there's many different kinds, right? So there's like, and they have different goals. And I think sometimes when people get frustrated with organizers or with activists, it's because they're not seeing all the different tactics that folks have to take on, right? So people get really frustrated with like rallies and with, you know, protests or like big taking of highways and stuff like that, because they're like, well, what do you want, you know? But like, that's necessary, because the point of that is to get people shaken up and riled up. But then there's this other point of it where you are, through like A, providing a service, and B, giving people power, making people feel like they can do something to bump up against the system in an effective, like direct service kind of way, that there's power in that, right? That we're creating the future that we want to, or like we, in some small pocket or in some small facet, we are creating and building the future we want to see, which is a future where our community has us and my community can protect me from the police, right? Because the police is not here to protect me, but my community can protect me and my community can hold me down. And so like for, as an organizing tool, there's a certain level of like power that the organizer feels, but also that the organizer is able to impart upon our community by being like, you know, in the midst of all of this, there is something very, very tangible and specific that you can do. Not only that, but there's some very tangible and specific information and knowledge that you have now, because they are dependent upon us not knowing our rights. They're dependent upon us not knowing how to hold each other down, because the police and the police state is dependent upon fear and is dependent upon us feeling like we need them, or like us feeling like we have to ask for permission in everything that we do. So there's like a power in that as an organizing tool, where you are making a demand, but at the same time that you're making the demand, you're looking to community to fulfill that demand ahead of time, right? Be like, we can do it for ourselves, but y'all should make it easier, you know? I think there's a lot of power in it. I think it's empowering for community. I think it makes folks feel like they have more control, organizers and community as well. And I think that it's a great way to make folks feel like they can start the entry point. We did an action in Brooklyn in May, and a young woman was like, oh, I wonder if I could do this with like my school, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, yeah, like absolutely, you totally could. Like, it's just like a matter of like fundraising, getting together some Metro cards and doing it and having your message together, because it's like really exciting to folks. The number of people who have said, well, wait a minute, like, how is it illegal to ask for a swipe, but it's not illegal to accept one? Like, that doesn't make any sense. And like that moment of like, it doesn't make any sense, but now I know that it doesn't make sense, is like really powerful for folks. And it's like a really great entry point and like segue into organizing and taking on your power.
And of course, in a quota driven NYPD, not only for the optics, but just on the strict concrete level of capital, these slave catchers are not appreciative to see this kind of action occur. What kind of response did you get from law enforcement officials?
Yeah, I mean, every time that we've done this action, the kind of law enforcement attitude has been, I mean, the attitude has been pretty much always the same, just law enforcement. They tend to just get really uncomfortable and not know what to do with themselves, right? Because at the end of the day, we're not breaking any laws. And they set up the laws to trip us up and to catch us and whatever, but we've very carefully crafted, like, the way that the action is set up, there is no law being broken, right? So we've had NYPD just stand around and try to just look intimidating, just be there to try to intimidate folks from taking a swipe, try to intimidate folks from talking with us. We've had NYPD try to talk to us to try to, you know, distract or to try to take attention away and try to center themselves. We've had NYPD actually approach one of our organizers while she was chanting and tell her that she needed to quiet down, arrest her for breach of peace for simply chanting in the subway. So, you know, imagine that, right? Imagine like a subway, like any New Yorker, like imagine a subway terminal, a subway station be considered a place where you have a reasonable expectation of quiet. Like, that doesn't make any sense, right? There's trains, people are walking around, like, how are you gonna sit here and try to criminalize someone just chanting? So they tried that. There's been all kinds of things, but I think that, yeah, it definitely makes me very uncomfortable. I think that a lot of it is also that we spend a lot of time doing community outreach and community engagement. So when we talk to folks who start a conversation with us being like, well, you know, the cops are only doing their jobs, and then finish a conversation with us being like, well, wait a minute, like, why is that their job? Maybe, like, fuck the police, you know? Like, I think that that's a very dangerous concept to them, that we're able to have conversations with our folks. That's dangerous. It's dangerous to have an informed community. It's very dangerous to the NYPD, especially around what our rights are and are not. I had an older woman one time when we were doing the action say, well, that doesn't, well, you know, the police are here to protect us. And I was like, well, how do they protect us? Like, by with their presence? And she said, yeah, with their presence. And when they're here, like, people don't do theft of service, right? And, you know, we talked a little bit about what the implications of theft of service are. But then I told her, you know, well, most of the time, you know, when folks are arrested, they're arrested by plainclothes officers. So if the goal was to, you know, what is the goal of that? To just, like, lie in wait and just pounce on people. And she was like, you're right, that doesn't make sense. Like, why wouldn't they just, you know, sit in front of the train and just, like, make sure no one's jumping if they were really worried about the theft of services, right? Why wouldn't they just sit right there in plain sight and just make sure nobody jumps instead of doing all this sneaky shit? And I was like, well, because it's actually more beneficial for them if someone does jump, right? And it's more beneficial to their quotas, it's more beneficial to whatever, that they're out here trying to trap people. Because it's not about enforcement of anything. It's about trapping people. It's about getting people caught up in the criminal justice system. And it's about hunting at the end of the day. And so, yeah, I think that kind of exchange of information, that kind of fellowship among community, that kind of, like, even what we talked about earlier, you said, you know, how can this encourage people to organize? That's very dangerous to NYPD. That's very dangerous to what they're trying to achieve. So, yeah, so the reaction has been mixed, but not positive.
Now, speaking of this kind of targeting and the criminalization of whole populations, the most recent glaring expression of the racialized criminalization of essentially just blackness, period, occurred with this FBI report about black identity extremists. Have you in any way noticed since the release publicly of this report any change in how you or BYP 100 might be approached by various entities of the state?
You know, it's hard to say. I don't know if it's since the report. I think that just recently there's been a trend away from being willing to talk about blackness in, like, a upfront and unapologetic way. I think that the whole, you know, black identity extremist label is, like, a really nice and easy way for folks to get across their intense anti-blackness without having to use the same language as other white supremacists, right? I don't think that I have noticed a difference since the report was released, but I just think it's just been a general trend, right? And I think that, you know, even, like, when we talk about unapologetic blackness, when we talk about even, like, being calling ourselves, like, Black Youth Project 100, I think that there is, like, this fear that people have about talking upfront in an upfront way about identity and talking in an upfront way about racialization, about criminalization, about what lies at the root of a lot of these, at the end of the day, anti-black tactics. I think we're looking at a change in how we're approached, right? We're aware that it might be coming around the bend. We're aware that it might embolden certain people that have been lying dormant for a little bit or that we haven't been seeing. But as of yet, we're just doing what we do, right? We're staying unapologetically black and we're doing what we do. And that rhetoric, maybe it's burgeoning, right? And we'll have to face it. And we're building ourselves up to be able to face it. But I haven't noticed anything in particular, no.
And what's on the horizon for BYP 100 NYC? Do you have any upcoming Swipe It Forward actions in the works or any other actions or initiatives that we should know about?
For sure, yes. Yeah. So BYP 100 NYC launched in May our own campaign to end broken windows policing, which is focusing on a specific NYPD and NYCHA policy called permanent exclusion. So we've just launched our campaign for home, which is a campaign against permanent exclusion. Permanent exclusion is this completely discretionary policy between NYPD and NYCHA in which folks upon arrest are subject to potentially being evicted from their homes and permanently banned from their home, banned in the sense that they can't even come onto NYCHA property to visit their family members. And as such, if they live with family members, their family members have a choice to make when a member of the household is permanently excluded. They have to either all move out, so effectively the whole family is evicted, or they have to sign a paper basically promising that they will kick out and ban this person from their household. But once they have kicked out and banned this person from their household, they then are subject to random search by NYCHA officials anytime during the day, unannounced, any day, to ensure that this family member who either was arrested or perhaps was arrested, convicted, served time in prison and has now come back home. People who are arrested and never convicted, as young as 16 years old, that these NYCHA officials are coming to make sure that you have not allowed this person into your home based upon this idea that housing is not a basic right, when we all know that it is. And it's also a form of surveillance. It's a way to give government officials constant, unchecked access to the homes of Black folks, mostly Black folks, right? Because a large part of the population of NYCHA housing is Black folks. And it's a total disrespect to folks' homes, to folks' families, and it doesn't even make sense on any level to remove family members from their support system. So that's kind of been our focus. During our last Black Support Action, we invited folks to a town hall that we are having. We're having it in Harlem, and we're inviting folks to come and talk more and build out our strategy onto a permanent solution.
And how does one go about getting involved in BYP 100?
If you are in New York City and you are a Black person between the ages of 18 to 35, you can email nyc.chapter@byp100.org. That's nyc.chapter@byp100.org. You can also just go to the byp100.org website, and there's links to all of our chapters. We have chapters across the country. We got a chapter in New York City, Washington, D.C., Detroit, Raleigh-Durham, Bay Area, New Orleans. And, folks across the country, if you're Black and between the ages of 18 and 35 and committed to organizing through a Black queer feminist lens, centering the most marginalized, then you can totally join. You just come to an orientation and come through. And you can also check out our campaign on Facebook. It's the Campaign for Home, HOME. You can check it out on Facebook. It's there. So it's the full words, Campaign for Home. And you can keep up with our campaign. You can keep up with upcoming actions, upcoming cycle forwards, upcoming town halls. And yeah. Oh, and on Twitter, Campaign for Home on Twitter as well.
Rahel Mekdim Pekka, speaking from New York City. Mumia Abu-Jamal, the nation's best-known political prisoner, remembers Dennis Banks, the American Indian Movement leader who died last week.
In the late 1960s and early 1970s, two names emerged from the Native American and indigenous community that stood for resistance to white repression and assaults on Native life, Russell Means and Dennis Banks. They were men who lived, at times, in urban America and experienced its impoverishment as well as its penchant for broken dreams. In a time of mass resistance and social upheaval shown by the anti-war and Black liberation movements, Banks was among thousands of young activists of Native indigenous communities who rose up to speak and act on behalf of the oppressed. In 1968, after leaving prison, Banks joined forces with Clyde Belcourt to found the American Indian Movement, AIM, which sought to organize scattered Native clan members into a militant, cohesive unit. At its height, it had some 25,000 members. AIM activists held protests at historic sites to draw attention to U.S. massacres of Native peoples as well as present-day injustices. In 1970, Banks and Means declared a day of mourning to mark Thanksgiving Day when AIM activists seized the replica ship dubbed the Mayflower II in Plymouth, Massachusetts, on TV when real Indians confronted whites in Indian garb. In 1972, a national caravan of hundreds seized the Bureau of Indian Affairs in Washington for a week to protest a long train of broken trees. In 1973, AIM activists led by Banks seize the town of Wounded Knee, South Dakota, the site of the infamous massacre of Indians in 1890. The siege, lasting over 70 days, would become a 20th century hotspot of conflict, armed conflict, between AIM and agents of the U.S. government. In his later years, Banks became an actor, and his striking chiseled features filled many a screen. He later became an educator in several colleges for Indian youth. On Sunday, October 29th, Dennis Banks, Ojibwe, living in his northern Minnesota Leech Lake Reservation, closed his eyes on the same land where his eyes first opened 80 winters ago.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.